Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. We've traveled to New York City to take part in Climate Week conversations. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
This time we get to reimagine the future of infrastructure with David Guilford, head of policy and strategic partnerships for Sidewalk Infrastructure Partners, or SIP. The company is leveraging cutting-edge technology and creative capital to build sustainable and resilient systems around the country. David, wonderful to have you here in New York City at 57th Street Pier, Techonomy Conference with Worth, Climate Week Day 3. Thanks for being with us on Path to Zero.
Thanks so much. Very excited to be here.
Looking forward to this conversation. Sidewalk Infrastructure Partners, and we're going to call it SIP from now on. Is that okay?
That's perfect.
Great. You're just in some fascinating projects, but I really want you to start maybe how SIP got started, how you're helping transform outdated infrastructure, and then do me a favor, even define infrastructure, because to me that could be roads, bridges. That's not what you mean.
Absolutely. So just to start, so SIP formed out of this recognition and belief that infrastructure systems were becoming outdated, and there was an opportunity to apply technology to make them better. And that's of course something that is easier said than done for a lot of reasons that we can get into. But sort of to start with, infrastructure can mean a lot of different things. But I see infrastructure as anything that enables our society, our way of life to function. It's often hidden. It's often hidden in plain sight. So it is roads and bridges, but it's also power networks. It's wireless networks. It's software that makes those things work. And SIP was formed to address what we saw as a gap between the innovations that, say, a traditional venture capitalist could fund, often that relate to software, and the difference between that and the traditional infrastructure projects of roads and bridges that a large infrastructure fund typically could address. So we were created initially as a part of Alphabet, Google's parent company, and then we spun out as an independent holding company about 5 years ago with this mandate to bring tech and innovation to infrastructure systems to make them better, more sustainable, resilient, and efficient.
And you spun out because you could kind of get out of that Alphabet moniker and maybe attract more capital, or just you wanted your own independence? Why'd you spin out?
Yeah, so the part of this is that the opportunity is just massive, and it's not something that anyone, company, technology company, or otherwise could address. And so the initial spin out was funded by Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, one of the largest investors in infrastructure. We've since brought in additional investors. So really the goal is to be able to find the best technology, the best people working on technology, and give them the resources and work together to build not only the technology itself, but to put that into the real world and build projects.
I know in thinking about this interview, you talk often about the intersection of policy, technology, and then capital. It really takes those three elements. Elaborate a little bit on maybe your approach and how that gives you maybe a superior advantage for either your investors or for perhaps the people that benefit from your investment.
Yeah, I think this comes down to the fact that infrastructure can't be just bought and sold and adopted the way that most things in the world are. Right? It's not a matter of just publishing a new app to the app store and having people use it. If you're building something for the public benefit, you need to go through a procurement process typically. You need to get the ability to build and develop that the projects. So what that means is that we need not only to find the best technologies, but we also need to pair them with a business model that can work for us and that can be sustainable, but also a partner in the public sector who has a shared goal and can provide the opportunity for us to build and operate a new infrastructure system that can help with a particular challenge. So to give you some examples, we've worked in everything from roads, as I mentioned, to plastics recycling, shared wireless networks, data centers, and the evolution of the electric grid. So all those are very different from one another, but they all have some intersection with the public sector. And by that, it could be that the government is the one that's providing some incentives or funding to make a transition happen, as is in the case for a lot of energy projects. It might also be that it's more on the regulatory side. For example, wireless networks, the FCC has certain objectives. There's lots of different entities that weigh in on that. But what I think makes our work both super interesting but also a bit unique is that we really embrace that. We don't look only for companies and technologies that can just quickly scale without the government. We really believe that we do need to find ways to work with the policies that exist today, the policies that may exist in the future, to be able to deliver things that scale and serve a real infrastructure need.
Interesting. You yourself have a really interesting background. Co-founded, I think, the Broadband Equity Partnership. And you served as Vice President for Urban Innovation and Sustainability for the New York City Economic Development Corporation. Talk about maybe how those experiences prepared you and then maybe even benefit you in this new role.
Yeah, I feel very lucky to have experienced life as a public sector employee as well as on the private sector side of the table. And I've made that transition a few times in my career between working in government, working with entrepreneurs, but from the government side of the table, to working in a startup, working in a larger company. And what that's really given me is an appreciation for both the strengths and limitations of any one sector. And so what that translates to in what I do now is ability to kind of, to some degree, empathize for the person on the other side of the table. So it's not, you know,
I've been
the other person, right? And it's easy to, for example, it's easy to complain about government processes being slow or inefficient, but sometimes there's either ways to accelerate the process or to, at a minimum, to understand the challenges that are going to lie ahead by really had that experience and also figure out, you know, there's some things that are changeable and there's other that are not. So being able to identify what actually is feasible very early on, I think, can help a lot with entrepreneurs either avoid spinning their wheels somewhere where they're not going to make a lot of headway, but conversely can help put them on a path to fast deployment, fast partnerships, and things like that.
So Path to Zero is really all about energy. And as you talk about infrastructure, and you touched on earlier, is the electric grid. You have kind of focused one of your investments on not only the electric grid, but making it more resilient. More rapid electrification, decarbonization goals, and then just kind of how electric grid fits into that broader energy transition. I think your vehicle for that is called Renew Home. Talk to us about Renew Home.
Absolutely. So to start with, I think this is a very exciting but challenging moment for the electric grid for a number of reasons. One is that after years and really decades of relatively flat growth in electricity demand, for a number of reasons, some of which we may get into later around data centers, the energy demand is going up.
Yeah.
At the same time...
And put those numbers in perspective. The grid, depending on where you are, has been 1%, 0.5% kind of growth. All of a sudden now we're seeing 2 to 5 with expectations in some cases of 20 to 30% growth, right, over the next 5 to 10 years. Are those numbers about right?
Yes, they are. And there's a lot of different estimates out there because no one, of course, can predict exactly how these technologies are going to develop. But the main thing is even a change from, say, 0.5% or 1% to 2% annual growth, that might not sound like a lot, but that translates into tens of billions of dollars of new investment that's needed every year and in different places around the country. So in addition to that growth, the other big transition happening is that there's been a lot of renewables added to the grid over the past decades. There's continued growth there. It's also been the retirement of some of the sort of traditional thermal baseload power plants, coal most notably. Keeping all this system working, where you have now a much more complex set of needs, on the one hand, people buying electric vehicles, charging them, electrifying their homes, and then on the other hand, having solar and wind that are contributing significantly to our decarbonization goals, but they also create some new challenges to balance. So really, with that backdrop, for several years, we've been developing what we refer to as virtual power plants. So initially working with a company called Ohm Connect that we've been an investor in for several years, got hundreds of thousands of households to enroll in programs through which their home energy use is optimized and adjusted based on the needs of the grid.
Right.
The most popular way that that has been done historically has been through integrating with smart thermostats. So adjusting your temperature by a few degrees in response to a particularly challenging time for the grid, you get the company can make money and individual consumers can save money and be incentivized and rewarded for that. Most recently, earlier this year, we closed a transaction through which we merged OhmConnect, the company that I referenced, with a piece of the Google Nest energy business called Renew. And so that created Renew Home, which now is building the largest virtual power plant in the country and has the ability to scale not only into smart plugs and smart thermostats, but also to integrate with hot water heaters, mm-hmm. with electric vehicle chargers, with heat pumps, with all sorts of things that are today a significant part of the grid, but that are growing even more rapidly than other parts of energy demand. What that means is that we can help preserve affordability for users, help with reliability, preventing blackouts, and ultimately save money and prevent a lot of investment that would otherwise be needed through sort of more traditional approaches. And just to give you a couple of statistics, right now the best estimates are that about 40 to 60% of the cost of the sort of traditional let me go back and start that one over if you don't mind. Thinking about the costs of virtual power plants, the big advantage that we've seen is that according to an estimate last year, it only cost about 40 to 60% as much to address this growing load demand through virtual power plants as opposed to traditional right. infrastructure construction. That could save utilities and consumers on the order of $15 to $35 billion over the next decade. There's also a big carbon side of the story too. And a study that was just published last week shows that this can really help us with a path to net zero. Today, virtual power plants across the country could shift about 1.5 to 7.3 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions, or reduce those emissions by shifting when energy is being consumed.
That's an annual number?
On an annual basis. But by 2035, this could grow to 12 to 28 million tons per year. Which would be around 2 to 4% of the projected energy demand in the U.S. at that time, and this could also enable the addition of more renewables into the grid because of that balancing of supply and demand on the order of an additional 200 megawatts by 2035.
Interesting, absolutely. So you've talked a couple times about data centers, huge power consumers. Actually, we don't talk about it much. Huge water consumers as well. Talk about how SIP's new company, I think called Varis, how you say it?
That's
Varis.
Right.
How that's interacting now with data centers.
So data centers often are invisible to people, but they use a tremendous amount of energy and water as well. A single search on a cell phone, as people have been talking about for a few years, uses a lot of power. But when you compare that to using a service like ChatGPT or generating an image through AI, you can use 10 or 100 times more energy for any given use. What that means, unsurprisingly, is there's been an almost insatiable demand for new data center construction and power. We saw this a few years ago, first looking at Ireland, where the national grid operator had paused new data center applications because of the challenges on the grid. And over the past couple years, we've been working on a company which we launched earlier this year called Varis, that has that is able to develop data centers that are more flexible parts of the grid. Traditionally, a data center has been something that just needs whatever size it is, 50, 100, 200 megawatts, it just needs that power 24/7 with sort of 99.999% reliability. What we believe is that by designing microgrids and integrating data centers into the electric grid in a more flexible way, including the incorporation of storage, whether it's lithium-ion or future technologies, data centers can be a flexible end user and flexible consumer, meaning that if they need to use less power in a given moment, they can reduce their consumption. That can support the addition of new renewables on the grid, can also contribute to reliability, and it can also provide grid services that help maintain the stability overall of the grid. You know, we've seen over the past couple years in areas like Northern Virginia, people who are trying to build data centers may be waiting 5 to 10 years to get connected to the grid. And we believe that by an approach that starts with the energy architecture that's needed for data centers, but not just data centers as they are today, data centers thinking about all the use cases, whether it's AI or otherwise, you could make them be a much better neighbor, a much better part of the grid, while contributing to the goals that we have as a country for economic development, for sort of industrial policy and strategy. And also, you ultimately help with some of the reshoring of manufacturing and other large energy consumers, because the grid really needs, on the one hand, individuals, you know, individual households to be flexible, as we talked about with Renew Home, but it also needs some of the largest consumers of energy, you know, the consumers that are measured in hundreds of megawatts, if not a gigawatt of power. Having them be more flexible can really create opportunities to have an efficient and dynamic grid that also becomes more and more sustainable.
We're certainly seeing the grid become an economic development tool. For me, fascinating to see how Georgia Power finally brings on Vogtle 3 and 4, I guess, and now manufacturing swiftly moving to Georgia. I can only believe that it's a short matter of time. In fact, the day is here where the availability of adequate power, perhaps the price of power, the reliability of that power, really will determine where companies locate. It might be the primary location device, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. In the data center world, I think you're already seeing that with places like California that have had either high power costs or just a difficulty in providing power on a reasonable time frame to people that are trying to build a data center. They've moved to Arizona or Nevada, where power
is more. In Northern Virginia. I thought every data center was in Northern Virginia.
Most, I mean, that is by far the number one U.S. market, but the number two U.S. market is the sort of San Francisco Bay Area, for probably obvious reasons, around Silicon Valley. But even Northern Virginia, for example, Maryland has seen an influx of data center applications because it's as close to Northern Virginia as you can get where power is available. This intersection between power availability, power reliability, also sustainability, because a number of companies are choosing where to use data centers, even whether or not they're the ones building it. They do care about the sustainability, not just footprint of the data center, but a number of companies have made commitments around using 24/7 carbon-free energy.
Right.
And so different parts of the grid have very different challenges and opportunities for actually achieving that.
Yeah, that's right. You're here in New York, and I know you've been doing a lot of things, but you're going to speak at a conference just a little bit later today. Governor's Island and Beyond, Scaling Urban Infrastructure for Climate Resilience. By the way, a star-studded group of speakers in that panel. I'm looking forward to it. But maybe will you preview for us your talk and kind of broaden out that topic, what you'll be talking about?
Yeah, so at the core of this is that you need a place for infrastructure innovation to really take shape. As much as smart people working in an office park might come up with new technologies, the proof is in the pudding in terms of actual deployment, but you also learn as you deploy. So it's really important to find places and for places to find technology that can bring first-of-a-kind type projects to life. For those not familiar with Governor's Island, it's a pretty special place. It's a former military facility that was turned over to the city a few decades ago and has become a hub for everything from public art to recreation to a new climate solution center that is being built. It's 172 acres, just 800 feet or 800 yards off the southern tip of Manhattan. And it's a place where there's both the challenges of climate adaptation happening firsthand in terms of being waterfront in New York Harbor, needing to be prepared for future storms, but it's also a place where researchers, universities, and others are investing in and developing and testing solutions. So one of the things we'll be talking about this afternoon is how to use a place as a testbed, but not just a testbed, a place that addresses the needs of residents and users of that place, but that has a pathway towards scaling and larger development.
Exciting. We've been talking with people about Governor's Island. It's quite interesting. All right, let's have a little fun. We're going to give you a magic wand. You get to use that wand one time for one thing in the next year that, in your opinion, would have the biggest impact on climate change. How would you use it, David?
Well, if that magic wand were truly unlimited, I think the thing I would wave it at is permitting and permitting reform. And in part, this is the reason why I think a magic wand is needed. In part, it's political, but it's also a really difficult challenge of how do you make sure that a project that is going to help with sustainability, help improve our economy, that project is both rigorously evaluated to make sure there aren't big unintended consequences, but that can speedily move through to construction. Whether we're talking about the need for data centers to have clean, reliable energy, or the need to build new transmission capacity. Often there could be delays of years, if not decades, from when a project could be built to when it actually is built. And I think in this world, time is money, and I think there are a number of great projects that could be possible if someone did have a magic wand that said, you know, not get rid of all permitting regulations, but have a process that is truly rational, has enough resources on all sides so that you can move through as quickly as possible and not be stuck in sort of a limbo where, you know, no one knows if the project is going to happen or not.
Permitting reform certainly kind of top of mind for a lot of people, so good use of your wand, thanks. National Forest, we're going to plant a tree. We love that you're here. We're looking forward to you speaking later. But in honor of the expertise you share with us, we want to plant a tree in your name in a national forest. Where would we plant it?
Well, that's a very wonderful gesture and offer. I'm a big fan of trees, and living in New York City, there's a lot of places that I think could use more trees. But thinking about national forests in particular, I'd have to go with the San Juan National Forest in southwest Colorado. It's where I spent a lot of my childhood, learned to ski, did a lot of hiking, but it's also a place that has been under a lot of stress. There's been drought, there's been fires, but it's a absolutely beautiful part of the country with all sorts of activities, with great communities, and so I would love for a tree to grow in that place.
Great. That's a beautiful area. We look forward to finding a tree there. That would be beautiful. All right, what else would you like to tell our listeners about SIP? Maybe what you're doing, how to learn more. What do you want them to know?
Yeah, I think for anyone interested in what we do, there's a lot that you can go to our website at sidewalkinfra.com.
Sidewalkinfra.com.
I'm also pretty easy to find on social media and things like that. But I think just in terms of what else I'd want people to know, it's that this really is a collaborative effort. It needs to be a collaborative effort to build the types of infrastructure solutions that are needed. We talked about the kind of policy side of things. There's a lot of great nonprofits that I'm also involved with that are working on building these types of projects, whether it's the U.S. Conference of Mayors has a public-private partnerships task force that I've been active with. And also there's something called the Innovative Infrastructure Initiative, where we're helping local communities get the resources they need to be able to evaluate innovative projects. So not specifically for SIP, but really just in general, how do we change the status quo and make it easier for someone that has a great idea to build something new and to go through whatever hoops are needed to get it out into the real world?
David Guilford, Head of Policy and Strategic Partnerships for Sidewalk Infrastructure Partners. Thanks for being with us today on Path to Zero.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins from Climate Week in New York City. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.